a beauty, but when she came to me, she must have thought I'd lost my mind. I couldn't hold her, cause the words that he told her kept coming back time after time. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucy, with four hungry children and a crop in the field. I've had some bad times.
Kenny Rogers has worn many hats over his six-decade career. He's a singer, songwriter, photographer, record producer, actor, and entrepreneur. And although he's often described as a country artist, he has charted more than 120 hit singles across the various music genres. It took him a while to achieve stardom, though, but he has received AMAs, Grammys, ACMs, CMA Awards, and was voted the favorite singer of all time in 1986 in a poll by readers of USA Today and People. And now he's written a memoir called Luck or Something Like It. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it has brought Kenny Rogers to our show today.
Thank you, sir.
And the song that we opened with was Lucille. It's your mother's name, but you didn't write it, so did you choose it because you liked that name?
Well, no, I loved the song, and I didn't even, you know, I know my mother's name, but it never crossed my mind that she would think it was written about her. She got so angry, and my mom never got mad, but boy, when she did, you knew it, you know. So she got...
What angered her?
Well, this, because she thought I was putting her business on the street, you know, four hungry children and a crop in the field, and I said, Mom, first of all, it's not about you. Secondly, I didn't write it, so don't go there. But she was a great lady.
And an influence on your life, I
totally,
imagine.
Totally.
What about your father?
I've said it since then that the thing I regret the most about my life is that I didn't really, and I'll use this expression, take the time to get to know my father and why he drank. He was a very happy drunk. He was always in a good mood, funny, great sense of humor. But I think there was such a stigma to drinking at that time. And what I realize now is that a lot of the guys from that era drank because they all, during World War II, they all worked at the shipyards and they all had great jobs. And then when the war was over, they all got fired, laid off. And he couldn't support the family, and I think it just broke his heart. So that's when he started drinking.
And he died when you were in your 30s.
So. I'm trying to think. No, I think I was... No, because he saw the success with the first edition. Mm-hmm. That I was thrilled with that. But he didn't see my personal success beyond the first edition.
Well, you've called this book Luck or Something Like It. So do you think you were just lucky?
Yeah. I wrote a song called Love or Something Like It that was a number one record. Mm-hmm. So we took... The whole idea... When you look back on my career, and this title came about after we started laying it out chronologically about how lucky I was to be at point A, to be able to get to point B, point C, and so forth around. Because, you know, when I was 19 years old, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I sold office supplies, and I met a young kid who was blind and played piano, sang like Ray Charles, and he invited me to come play in his jazz group. And from there, you may or may not remember Kirby Stone, mm-hmm. a group called the Kirby Stone Four. He became my mentor.
And well, you weren't even a bass player at the time. You had sung doo-wop in high school.
Right, yeah.
So you've been, even then you were all over the place. But you had to learn how to play upright bass?
Yeah, I played guitar, and I told Bobby, I said, sure, I'll join your group. I even play guitar. He said, no, I need you to play bass. I said, but I don't play bass. He said, well, I'll teach you. So he literally taught me how to play bass. And he taught me all that great music of the 30s and 40s. And you really get a good musical foundation from that. Mm-hmm. So then from there, I went to the New Christy Minstrels, which was totally the opposite.
Well, had you listened to jazz before? You talk about growing up in the San Felipe Quartz housing projects in Houston's Fourth Ward. You want to make the point here that it's not Houston Heights.
Yeah. That's the rich part of town.
So were you growing up in a mixed neighborhood where you might have heard all different kinds of music?
I never heard jazz. I didn't even know jazz existed until Bobby showed me and taught me how to play. I mean, literally, it was a musical education because he was blind. He had nothing else to do. So we rehearsed 4 or 5 hours every day, and we worked 8 hours a night. We would go to work at 5 o'clock till 7 and do a cocktail job, 7:30 till midnight. We played a dance job, midnight till 3 o'clock in the morning. We played an after-hours job. But at 19, in 1957, I was making $800 a week.
That was a lot of money then.
It was a tremendous amount of money.
Will your country music fans be surprised that when they learn that you sang doo-wop when you were in high school?
Well, I think everybody sang doo-wop in that period in high school because that's really what it was.
We all try to sing Earth Angel.
Yeah, right. That's the song I always reference to.
So, and then came gospel music. So you're playing jazz, but you were also interested in gospel music because that was the music of the church you went to?
Well, the last album I did it for the Cracker Barrel restaurant chain, and because I never wanted to proselyte. I never wanted to get on stage, talk about my religion. I've never been overtly religious, but I've always been deeply spiritual. So when they gave me the opportunity to do this and I didn't feel like I was imposing my values on someone else, that these people, they know their market. That's who they are. They handle the middle-aged to older religious person. So they gave me the chance to do this. It was a great opportunity.
But again, this is another example of you switching genres. And I wonder about that. Most people find a comfort zone and they want to stay there. You go from jazz to the new Christie Minstrels.
Right.
That is a big culture shock.
Huge, because the Christies was the ultimate form of simplicity, but it was music with a message. So I learned something. I learned to appreciate what it was. And from that, I went to the first edition, which was kind of country rock.
And that was where you had your first top 10
recording
on the Billboard charts. My guest is Kenny Rogers. He has written a memoir called Luck or Something Like It. It is published by William Morrow. And you've published other books, but this is the first book you've really written?
Yeah, I never wanted to do this. I never wanted to write a memoir, you know. And I was talking to the girl that was going to help me write it, Patsy Cox. And Patsy had written 8 or 10 of these. And she said that, I said, well, why would I want to do this? And she said, well, you know, Johnny Cash died without doing one, and there's a lot of musical history that's lost because he didn't bother to do it. And so I thought, well, okay, I'll do that, but I'm not going to write a he said, she said. I just refuse to get into that. But I also, now that I've done it, what really thrills me is I have identical twin boys that are 8 years old. And I took a book, I got the first two books, and I numbered them for them. And I wrote in them, maybe someday this will help you find out who I really was. I expect a lot from you. Don't let me down.
You had those kids when you were 66 years old?
Yeah. Say a prayer for me.
Well, you were in the successful group that you mentioned, First Edition, producing hits. Those groups always have some tensions in them. Were there problems?
Well, there is a group dynamic. Anytime you're in a group, there's always a group dynamic in that you have competition within that group. I was lucky because I found all the hit songs. You know, whoever finds a song, that's what we did. Mike Settle.
You weren't writing them yet?
No. I don't have a need to write. I can write if I have to. But most really great writers have a need to write. And I don't have that. I've got so many other outlets for my whatever talent I might have. But when I heard these songs, Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, Reuben James, they fall into a category that I love, which is a story song with a message. Reuben James is about a black man that raised a white child. Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town was about a Vietnam War vet who came back trying to work his way into, if you take Coward of the County, it was about a rape. So all those songs have some social significance above being great songs.
You're performing in this group at a time when almost every group was experimenting with drugs. You suggest that not much of that happened with this one.
We didn't. We were all pretty straight from it. And the only reason I did is because the guy that wrote just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in, which was really psychedelic. Under anybody's stretch of imagination, he came to my house. He said, you got to try this. I said, I don't want to do this, Mickey. He said, no, come on. It's psilocybin. He told me it wasn't acid, which is another word for acid. So I dropped one psilocybin tablet. First 8 hours, I have to admit, was the most incredible experience of my life. The second 8 hours, I'm not sure about. The third 8 hours scared me to death. But, you know, I swore I'd never do it again, and I didn't.
So you never performed under the influence?
No, well, one time I smoked some marijuana before I went on, and I have to admit, I thought I was awesome. I mean, I really thought I rose above the crowd when I did that. And then when I got off, the guys were saying, what were you talking about when you started? I said that on stage. So I realized that
you're just rambling.
Yeah, I was running on.
Now, I get the feeling that all of these things were learning experiences for you. I mean, did you bring your jazz experience to the first edition?
Yeah, and if you think about it, how many other country artists could sing songs like We've Got Tonight through the years? Because those are really pop ballads. And you know, the guys like Willie and Waylon, as great as they are, they have no experience in singing that type of music. So I think that's what helped me, is that I've always said I'm a country singer with a lot of other influences.
But there's always been a certain amount of crossover. I remember hearing Joe Hinton, who came out of gospel music, singing a Willie Nelson song, having a big hit with it.
Right.
I didn't even know at that time that Willie Nelson had written it and done his own record of it, because I was growing up in New York.
Great stuff, too.
Yeah, but I mean, it's my sense that people were always listening to each other's music. You hear Sister Rosetta Tharpe in Johnny Cash and in Elvis Presley. So the music was a lot less segregated than people tend to think it was.
Well, except that country music has always been very, very insecure. They didn't want a lot of other influences in it because they could control what was in it. And once influences, and I think myself included, but I also believe I brought a lot of people to country music that wouldn't have listened to it otherwise. And I think once you listen to country music, you don't go back. Because country music is like the white man's rhythm and blues. It's the pure, it's where the pain is. And that's what I think people relate to.
There's another side to it. In the 60s, with the Beatles and other groups, where suddenly everybody was a singer-songwriter. But country music, Nashville, was still like the old Tin Pan Alley, where you had songwriters who had that job. You had producers who had their jobs, A&R men. It was very much like what had produced the earlier R&B hits out of the Brill Building in Manhattan.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you needed that at that time because there were a lot of great singers who weren't songwriters. So it gave them an opportunity to go ahead and perform. But like you said, there were great songwriter singers too, and they survived through it too.
So what happened with the first edition? It broke up around the time that your father died and your marriage fell apart.
No, well, the timing is not totally correct on that. Which marriage? You know, because I've been married 5 times now, but, you know, I'm not afraid of
commitment. You couldn't get it right?
I'm not afraid of commitment, I can tell you that. No, it's like, in all honesty, I know this sounds crazy. I loved every woman I married. I truly loved them. But in the book I talk about, there's just a fine line between being driven and being selfish. And I think I crossed that line. I think I wanted success so badly that in some cases I sacrificed my marriage for it.
Isn't it also difficult to maintain that kind of career because you're touring all the time? You have to spend an awful lot of time away from the home to maintain a career.
And that's the problem, because in those, more so at that point in my career, I was working 6 months out of the year on the road. I mean, you disconnect. You have to do that.
So you moved to Nashville and try to establish a solo career. Were you afraid that you might not be able to do that because you'd always worked within groups?
But if you look back over the first edition's career, excluding just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in, and maybe something's burning, we were a country group. We had Reuben James, Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, Coward of the Cow, I mean, a song called But You Know I Love You. We had 8 top 10 records as country artists.
Kenny Rogers is my guest. He's written a memoir called Luck or Something Like It, and it is published by William Morrow. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in?
I woke this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bombed a cigarette and asked me for a light. And the night got deathly quiet, and his face lost all expression. Said, if you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
Kenny Rogers is my guest. He's one of the best-selling artists of all time with more than 120 million albums sold worldwide. And we're listening to his the song that gave him his first Grammy, The Gambler. He has written a memoir called Luck or something like it for William Morrow. And what about The Gambler? Did that change your life? Because you already were selling pretty well.
But you know, you can have hits, but that is really a career maker. It's an identifiable record. I became the gambler. I did 5 major films for CBS and NBC. All of them won their weeks. It was the longest running miniseries in history, and it was a great success. So I became Brady Hawkes.
And it was one of those rare instances where a song inspired a movie.
Yeah, well, I did one on Coward of the County as well, and then a 6-pack movie too.
So I imagine this just opened up all sorts of other opportunities for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's like once you get that record, that's the one everybody prays for, something that they can be identified with.
Before that, it looked like you were going to have a very nice country career. You did those duets with Dottie West, for example.
That was Dottie singing background on The Gambler.
Was
it? You can hear her voice back there.
There was this tradition in country music of duets that you don't hear all that much in other genres in American pop music. But was she the one who you automatically connected to?
Well, it's interesting. The same guy that produced me, Larry Butler, produced her. And so he was producing her, and her session was to have been over, and mine was to have started, and she was running late. And I'd never met her, and I'm sitting in the control room with Larry. And she said, "Is that Kenny Rogers in there?" And he said, "Yeah, it is. Come say hello." She said, I want to sing him with him on one of my records." And I'd been there long enough to hear she was doing Every Time Two Fools Collide. I said, "Dottie, I can sing that song." So literally, I went out and sang that song with her.
Well, it's important for voices to work together.
Yeah.
Are you in the similar range? Is your voice pretty much the same today as it was 30, 40 years ago?
I think it is, yeah. But, you know, what happens is in country music, you never start with an artist that you want to sing with. You start with a song. Say, who can sing this? I tried several times with Dolly within the last 5 years to find a song we could do, and they just seemed oddly inappropriate for me and Dolly because we have an image together. And we can't do ballad love songs. And so it was hard to find a song to do that to.
Although you both have relatively voices in the higher ranges.
Yeah, hers is really high. Mm-hmm. And so we can sing in the same key. With Sheena Easton, we did We've Got Tonight. We did that in one key. We didn't change it. We didn't do any modulations at all, which was very unusual in duets.
So how did the movie, the concept of the Gambler being filmed come about?
Well, when we did the song, it was the album cover. And so Ken Cragen was my manager at the time, who was like one of the bigger managers in California. And so he hired a guy named Reed Miles to take the picture. Now, Reed Miles did still shots for movies. That was his specialty.
This is another one of those luck or something like
it stories.
I'm
telling you. And so he takes this picture of me at a gambling table with a bunch of people from the Old West, and he pumped it full of smoke and took this picture. We had a life-size one blown up for when we went in to do our promotion for the album. And the guys from CBS were there, and Ken said, "Now, doesn't that look like a movie to you?" The guy said, "Yeah, we should do that."
Yeah, but you then had to learn how to act. Did it
come
natural?
No, I never bothered to do that. Yeah. I think there are actors and there are people who can act. Actors are people who can take unbelievable dialogue and make it believable. I can take believable dialogue and keep it believable. I found out that I'm really good at being me in a bunch of different clothes.
Mm-hmm.
I've done Westerns. I've done detective stuff, six-pack. I was an auto racer. But it's still just me.
And did you like acting?
Liked it, didn't love it. You know, but I loved the end result. When it was all put together and it was a piece of work, if you will, I did like it. I did like what we did.
Well, what did you think was going to happen? Were you getting bored with just being a country recording artist?
No. I think it was just, it was really an opportunity. And Ken Cragen, as I said, he's like my new manager, Ken Levitan. He's very global. He doesn't just think this here and now. He believes in layered success. You do this, you put something on top of it, put something on top of that, and it's worth a lot more than any one of them were. So he believed this was important to move my career along. So we did it almost as a lark because it was available to us.
Are you still acting?
No, I get offers every now and then, but I don't have any interest in
it. Well, talk about layers. The next step is you collaborate with Lionel Richie.
Yeah. Well, he's been my buddy for 40 years. I talked him into moving to L.A. when the Commodores broke up. He came to L.A. He lived in Tuskegee, Alabama. I said, "You are not going to make it from Tuskegee." And I had a big house in L.A., and so I moved him out, and he stayed in my guest house for a couple of years. But he and I have been buddies all that time.
Would you describe your collaboration as a kind of reinvention for both of you?
Well, I think that what for me, certainly, and I think Lionel has now caught this country bandwagon because he is the master of writing conversation. You know, you listen to songs like Hello, Three Times a Lady, Still. It's like two people talking. And you hear that and you think, I could have written that, but you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really the best at that. And he came and did this album, and it's the smartest album I've ever seen. He took songs everybody knew and did them with artists everybody loved, and had to be a huge success.
And then you started collaborating with Dolly Parton. You did Islands in the Stream. But you say that part of the problem there was that you both established stars with images, and it's not so easy to collaborate under those circumstances.
It's not, but what happened that was interesting is Barry Gibb had written that for somebody else, Smokey Robinson or somebody.
Of the Bee Gees, Barry.
Yeah, of the Bee Gees. And so I wanted him to produce something on me because I wanted to do something different than I'd ever done before. So he came out and I sang Islands in the Stream for 4 days solid. And I just finally said, "Barry, I don't even like this song anymore." And it was like an epiphany. He raised his finger and he said, "We need Dolly Parton." Well, I didn't know Dolly. I'd met her once before. But, again, my manager, Ken Cragen, said, "I just ran into her." So he went and called her, and 30 minutes later, she came marching in the studio. And once she came in, the song was never the same. And my career was. That's another one. It's like Island in the Stream. I mean, it's like The Gambler. It's a career maker.
It would have been all different if they had called Loretta Lynn instead.
I think so. I venture to say yes.
While you were on tour in 1985, Dolly said, "I always thought that if Johnny Mathis and Willie Nelson had a kid, it would sound just like you."
I've tried to get that in my head. I can't really imagine it.
So, and then you did work with Willie Nelson later too, didn't you?
We've done some shows together, yeah.
So how did your name get attached to Kenny Rogers Roasters?
Well, John Y. Brown, who had Kentucky Fried Chicken, had since then left that place, and he found this formula somewhere, and he wanted to do it. And he asked me, and I thought it was, first of all, I went and tried it. It was great food. It was very tasty, very healthy. It was the first real concept that had health in mind.
Because it wasn't fried chicken.
No, it wasn't. The grease dropped, rotisserie, and the grease dropped off the chicken. So, and it was very tasty, and all the side dishes were good. So I agreed to do it, and it was very successful for a while, but poorly managed. But it's still a major, major effect in foreign countries.
Well, the problem for many artists is when their name is attached to a franchise, food franchise, in a way, some people see it as diminishing them.
Why? I mean, if it's successful, and when Jerry Seinfeld does it on his show, it's successful.
He once dedicated a whole episode to Kenny Rogers Roasters.
We gave him all the pictures and stuff, the gold records to put in the show.
So did they call you?
They called my management, but Jerry had opened for me when he first started. Yeah, and it was he's really an amazing guy. So the fact is, I thought it was really funny, the fact that they tried to kick us out. And it's a true story, you know. You know, when you smell chicken in the afternoon, it smells great. You smell it at 9 o'clock in the morning, it's not great. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. People in this building were saying, we can't take that at 9 in the morning. So they tried to kick us out of the area. And so then of course, Kramer falls in love with the chicken. But in real life, he's a vegetarian. So he would do all those scenes and chew it, and then he'd have to spit it out when the scene was over.
He didn't know that. Some of it still went down with the saliva.
Yeah, I think he liked it, basically.
But the oddest part of the story is that Jerry Seinfeld once opened for you.
Yeah.
That does not seem like a match that I would imagine.
Well, you know, at the peak of my career, I always had a comedian and another act working with me because you don't want three musical acts. The setup time's too long. And I've had some great comedians working with me. I had Gallagher work with me, where he would bust a watermelon in the front row. So that was an interesting experience. But Jerry came out to work with me, and he missed the first show because my brother Leland was traveling with us, and it was his job to get him over there. Well, he took him to rehearsal, and Jerry came back and was sitting in the lobby, and no one picked him up. So we come back at the end of the show, and he says, I didn't know where to go. So he missed the first show with us.
My guess is Kenny Rogers, who's written a memoir called Luck or something like it. You're also a photographer.
Right.
You've published a couple of books. Did you start taking pictures because you can get pretty bored on the road?
Well, it is an important factor because what happens is the reason I think these guys on the road get into drugs is that the show is such a high and you come back and the rest of the show, the rest of the day is so low. That without that, you start looking for ways to raise up the energy level. So when I started doing photography, I realized I was pretty good at it. Someone said I was a great photographer. I said, I'm a good photographer who goes to great places. That's the key.
You definitely have access to all sorts of things that the rest of us don't.
Yeah, I'm going to Singapore in 2 weeks, you know.
And also, you got to photograph a lot of people that in relaxed situations that I might not be able to photograph.
Yeah, my first book was called Your Friends and Mine. Had Elizabeth Taylor on the front cover, Michael Jackson in the middle, four presidents of the United States, George Burns, you know, Walter Matthau, Ava Gabor. I mean, it was just, I lived in L.A. and I had a studio. I promised everybody they'd be out, in and out in 15 minutes. I was doing it with an 8x10 camera. I took two black and white and two color. I said, if I don't get it in one of those, it's my problem.
When you look back at all of the people that you've met, people that you probably, that even a successful country singer might not have met, are you surprised by how your life took so many odd turns?
Yeah, I'm. That always amazes me because I was a country singer, but I made a lot of money and I lived in L.A., so I was a part of that big social scene out there. And so I got a chance to meet it. I had credibility with them when I came in. And it was a great chance for me to kind of get to know people I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Well, four presidents. So we're talking about people of both parties.
Right. And a picture,
was it easy to, for you to maintain?
Hillary Clinton. I almost had five.
Was it easy for you to maintain that kind of nonpartisan image?
Yeah, I honestly didn't even know what party they belonged to, because that's not a big deal for me. I'm a guy who likes to get involved with the concept rather than the person.
So what's happening now? You're still making music. You're touring with a show. Have some people say they get really tired of touring after a while? You're 74 years old. Yeah. And you're still touring?
Well, I do 100 shows a year. And I had Someone asked me the other day if I still enjoyed it. I said, getting there is not as much fun as it used to be. But once I get there, there's no place in the world I'd rather be.
And you said you're going to be in Singapore next week?
And Kuala Lumpur after that.
Have you ever been there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's been years ago. The guy that put up the money for Roasters is in Kuala Lumpur, so we're going to hook up and say hello.
Do people all over the world recognize you? I mentioned earlier you sold 120 million records worldwide, but I'm assuming that's in countries where country music is popular.
It never ceases to amaze me. I did another National Public Radio show this morning, and they let them tweet in, and some guy from Iran tweeted in, and a guy from Uganda who said, I learned to speak English listening to Kenny Rogers' music. And I've had that from all over the world, from Korea. And I was in China 30 years ago, and this girl, we went out, I was just visiting. I wasn't even there performing. And the girl at the, we went to this restaurant who plays the pipa. It's like a guitar you play with a bow. And we were eating, and she had a break. She went to her car and came back, and she had four of my albums in her car. And she asked me to sign them for, which I thought was very cool.
You have a bunch of things that you're doing around town?
Around town, oh, yes. Oh, I'm wearing out.
Do you remember any of them?
Not many, but okay. Some of them.
Well, my staff is going to have to pass that on to me. You have a meet and greet at Bookends in New Jersey.
Whatever you say.
That's tonight at 6.
They push me and point me.
Well, they do. They say, get in the car. And
go. We'll let you know when to get out.
And tomorrow at 1 at the Barnes & Noble store on 54th Street and 3rd Avenue.
Whatever
you're going to be there and signing books.
If you want me there, I'll be there.
Well, the book that we've been talking about is Luck or Something Like It, a memoir. It's published by William Morrow. And here we're going to go out with Islands in the Stream.
Awesome. Great song, great partner.
And thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Islands in the Stream, that is what we are.